Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. Today we've got a topic that if you love the unique and the unusual, I think you'll find just as fascinating as I did. My guest is James Okan, and his book is The Lost Secrets of Maya Technology. Do you believe that other cultures were superior to us in various aspects of technology? And if so, why? Well, if you really can't answer those questions, James can. And I think you'll find our chat today a fascinating one. James, rather Jim, which is what you preferred to be called by, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, Jim, I was totally intrigued with not just the title of your book, but with the fact that you are a engineer. You have been involved with all kinds of projects, different places, you've won awards for your work, but yet you have had this incredible curiosity about the Mayan culture, their engineering, and you've become so deeply involved in the discovery of technologies that they utilized, and you just absolutely have this passion that very few people would have wanted to pursue. What do you think it was that created the seed for this curiosity about a culture that's so old? Where did it come from? How did it get started?
I had an interest in history and archaeology beginning in high school. And I went to technical university, so there wasn't any push there, but later, I started traveling, and first in Spain, I spent almost a year, and then I spent the better part of a year in Mexico, living among the Maya ruins and beginning to feel the a closeness with the Maya engineers who built those beautiful cities and the infrastructure that allowed them to work in a really diverse environment. And The real passion began when I began to ask questions of archaeologists about this. Isn't this concrete? No, they couldn't make concrete. But look at this carving over here; it's just so fine. What kind of tools do they use? They use just a flint. I'm going, no, it'd be harder than that. And on and on and on. The roads, the bridges. Well, that was my first big find, was a bridge. But that, I'm going beyond your question now. Things fell in my lap because I saw things in plain sight that archaeologists couldn't see because they're not trained technicians. I hate to lower myself to that standard, but I saw the technical aspects of most of the projects.
You've made a comment that I think is very interesting. Sometimes when we get educated, we buy into paradigms without examining them to see if they really are correct. And I think one of the greatest strides that's being made at this time of people outside of the conventional environment, which really historically is pretty much the case anyway, those people that are not encased in their particular perceptions, they don't own them, they're open to different factors, then they can see. And I think that it is really a challenge. You have to be open and willing to learn different perspectives instead of just saying, well, this is because so-and-so said this, it's absolutely the gospel. Well, maybe not. And that's what you did.
Exactly.
You said, wait a minute, I don't know this, that, or the other. You said, I'm open. And I think that is a very valuable lesson for any of us to learn. Now, one of the things that you bring out right in the very beginning of your book, which I was really intrigued by, and that is that the Mayan culture had what you described as an artificially high population. And when disaster struck in the Yucatan Peninsula, and it was a drought, it was the worst drought in 7,000 years. I mean, those facts really intrigue me. But no matter how good their technology was, they could not survive that drought. And I had not heard anybody talk about it. It's always, well, some great mystery, they just disappeared. Or maybe it was illness, maybe it was that. Well, illness could hit. But the thing is that there was natural effects that occurred that devastated everything. It could happen anywhere, anywhere at all.
It has happened to other civilizations. But this one is ours. It's in our backyard. It's an American civilization because, you know, the American continent goes all the way down to Tierra del Fuego. And I feel closest to them because we're all Americans. And they are the closest civilization that was built up, as we see them, with their cities and their sciences and technology, that was absolutely decimated. 98% of the people passed away during the collapse, during the long drought. And the people who were left just couldn't, and nobody, there weren't enough people left to occupy and maintain the city, so it was easier living in a traditional house and growing your own food and surviving on your own without having to maintain a city. So the cities were never occupied. Anyway, that's how, you're absolutely right about that. And there's other civilizations that were wiped out by droughts and stuff like that, but this is our own.
Mm-hmm. You also made some interesting comments that the Mayan civilization is one of known history's longest-lived cultures. And it had more cities and pyramids than ancient Egypt. They were governed by more than 50 independent city-states. They were spread out over a 125,000 square mile area of the Mayan world. And they had their class status. They had the royalty, the scribes, the scientists, the intellectuals, the merchants. And you said they were there for more than a millennium. Boy, this is so different than what I ever was taught in the history books. Most of the history books depict them as a people that just, they never invented the wheel, but I'll tell you that when you said they had wheels on the toys, so they knew about the wheel, but it wasn't an efficient way of doing business, which intrigued me. I mean, you think of us with automobiles and how important the wheel is in modern day civilization for transportation. But tell us what was more efficient in the Mayan environment than the use of the wheel, though they had it on toys.
Well, I'm sure you read that. I was intrigued by the beginnings. The beginnings of not having draft animals. They did not have any beasts that were beasts of burdens. We, here in North America, this is the original home to the horse and the camel. And these two creatures split off into two different herds. One went north and one stayed south here in the southern part of the North America. And the northern herds migrated over the Bering Bridge, land bridge, to Asia, where they were domesticated and supplied the power for all the empires that we all read about, the Romans and the Greeks and the Egyptians. And the southern herds stayed put. Something happened in the end of the Pleistocene period called the Holocene extinction, where all these animals were absolutely went extinct. Nobody knows why. That includes also the mastodon and the mammoth and the saber-toothed tiger and all these great animals. Men didn't kill them off. There was more animals, and they're bigger than any of the men that could have made it over at that time. So when the Mayans started building their cities, they were not an empire, by the way. The 50 city-states were independent, like the Italian city-states were independent during the Middle Ages. They didn't know what a beast of burden was. They'd never seen one. They'd seen big animals. They'd seen bears and deers, et cetera, but those animals did not have any capacity or any, they were not willing to be domesticated. So So they used the one thing they had plenty of, manpower. And they developed devices that went that were back supported, head supported, rested on your back. They called it, we'll call it what they we call it now, a tump line. It's a bearing pack that allows you to carry up to 125 pounds, which is equal to the weight of a mile worker. And they could travel all day and on 2 pounds of corn, while it would take 15 pounds of corn to feed a horse each day. And using this device, they knew about the wheel, but they couldn't, well, they could build a cart. They could build a cart, say, weighed 1,000 pounds. Well, it would take 10 men to pull the cart, and X number of men, say it was 1,000 pounds, 10 more men to carry the load. That's 20 men to carry 50 pounds each of a gross usable load. So they did it the easy way. They carried the loads on their backs, and when it built, they carried the loads vertically on their backs on scaffolding to carry the brick and the concrete and the mortar upward, etc. So manpower was the answer. All the kinetic energy they used in transportation and in construction and in anything you think of, farming, was manpower.
You brought out in your book so many fascinating aspects of the sophistication of these people. I was just excited to learn about their water systems, that they had aquaculture. You know, we make such a to-do about it today. The Hawaiians had aquaculture, and very seldom do you hear of anybody talking about how different groups of people had already done something like this and were quite successful at it and enabled them to feed masses of people. And the Mayans did that too. But let's talk, before you get into the aquaculture, what I'd like for you to talk about is their water management, because where they built their cities, unlike many cultures that would build it totally on a coastal line, let's say, because you had water, or you had you build it on a lake, you build it someplace where you had a dependable water source. That was not always the case with them. Tell us why and how did they deal with the essence of water?
Thank you. Two elements. One was the fact that they had a seasonal rainy season, which 6 months of the year it rained absolutely tremendously and had deluges. And 6 months of the year there was no rain. So you had a virtual drought at 6 months of the year. So to survive as a family or a village or a city, you had to store water during the rainy season and use that water during the dry season. So the Maya had various methods of managing the water. Oh, the idea of the lake or river, there are hardly any. The lakes and rivers are very rare in the Yucatan. And the reason is the Yucatan Peninsula is a porous limestone shelf, a karstic limestone stone. And it's only 2 or 3 feet of dirt over the soil, over the top of this limestone. So when it rains, the rain goes right into the soil and goes into the stone. Instead of resting on a stone like everywhere else, it just gets sucked right down through the stone into the aquifer. And it's not available to be impounded for lakes, or it doesn't run on the surface like streams do, like rivers or lakes. So the only exception are the cenotes, the deep wells in the northern part of the Yucatan. So everywhere else you had to store water and manage it. So they solved this by building underground structural I'm going to call it reservoirs. I almost said they were called chaltoons. That's why I got a little confused there. And they slope all their plazas and their roofs of their buildings, etc., in a vicinity of a chaltoon, and the water would run in and collect during the rainy season, and they could use it during the dry season. But then there was also the open reservoirs. Cities that use this actually shaped their cities. The hills and slopes of the acropolises, the roofs of buildings, the hardscape, etc., would all be sloped towards a big reservoir. and this was open, and they could use the water for agriculture and for drinking during the dry season. Then, of course, some people had too much water, like the city of Palenque, where they use underground structural aqueducts to divert the water from the downtown area, down the center of the city, and routed it into a river. So they created public space. So they were extremely clever in their capabilities of managing water.
I was also intrigued. You think in today's world, in the big cities, we have water filtering systems. If water is not filtered, if we do not treat water, it's highly polluted, cholera, all kinds of horrific diseases become devastating to a population. Now, these people, a long, long time ago, knew that polluted water was deadly, and they had a biological water treatment system. One part of it, and I'm going to quote it from your book, they used water lilies planted in large open reservoirs because it contributed to the preservation and filter treatment of stored water. The wide leaves of the plant floating on the surface reduced evaporation by providing a surface cover and shade to prevent algae growth. And the stem and root system of the water lily recycled organic waste. They produced and enriched dissolved oxygen into the stored water. They provided a microenvironment for numerous invertebrates that ensure extensive natural purification. You go on with this. Then they were aware that frogs and dragonflies and salamanders controlled mosquito larvae. I mean, they had a natural biological system, but what really blew me away in your book was the story about the platform of the cones. Tell us about this discovery and what it meant.
You know, this is the first time anybody's talked about that. The platform of the cones, which is now called the platform of Venus. This book was reviewed by four famous archaeologists, and they were wonderful in their tribute. Nobody's mentioned that particular strange association of the cones and the platform. Right now, if you go to Chichen Itza, those cones are sitting in a little fence just next to the platform, like they're orphans. They were found in the platform in 1880 or so by the Le Pontier family, and nobody's ever been able to figure what they are. And in my book, I say that I think that the platform of Venus, which is a very unusual type of structure anyway, was a water treatment plant where they got water from the big cenote. There was two. There was one to the north and the south of the platform, and processed it through the limestone filters, those cones, and developed the clean water from the filtering system.
It's absolutely amazing. When I look at your photographs, you have so many fabulous photographs. You also did diagrams because you are an engineer, and you found so many points of information, and in your mind, so much of this was logical. So many people, if they don't have the kind of background that you have, wouldn't have a clue as to what to even recognize or look for. Now, what I was really, there's just so many points in your book, just the lost secrets of Maya technology that I absolutely was just awed by, because I think it's exciting when we recognize that because there were ancient peoples didn't mean they were nincompoops, that we need to respect and appreciate and keep an open mind to find out what is it that enabled them to create these phenomenal environments. You talk about bridge technology. Now, we pride ourselves on the Golden Gate Bridge. We've got so many bridges that have been built that are just absolutely incredible. These people utilized the materials that were around them, and they created a phenomenal bridge. Building bridges was very important, and it connected one part of the Mayan civilization with another part in many areas where you had, you know, great distances, it would be very difficult to get from one point to another. It would take you 10 times longer if you tried to do it by boat or otherwise. Tell us how you discovered this, because this was really a big aha when you came out with this information.
Well, I was in a dugout canoe going downstream to the city of Yaxchilan on the Usumacinta River. And as we were landing, I saw a structure, a ruined structure about 12, 14 feet high in the river. And I looked across at the opposite shore, which is like 200, 300 feet away, and it was a smaller, less defined structure. And I said, gee, they've had a bridge here. I mean, you know, typical engineer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the archaeologist said, impossible. I said, what? He said they were Stone Age people. They did not have the technology to do a structure like this. So I pointed them to the hills, which had these wonderful structures on them. They've been there for 1,400 years. I said, what about those? He said, oh, typical Stone Age buildings. Well, he was completely wrong. And you picked a good point. That was really set me off on my quest, because that bridge was made out of all the inventions that were required to build a city: cement, composite structures, the Maya arch, and the ropes that suspended the bridge, just like we use steel cables now to suspend bridges. Those ropes had the same strength. They had 18,000 pounds of square inch capability and tension, which is that's a lot of load. These same ropes were used throughout the world for ships and for construction until wire rope and steel came into play in this century. No, I'm sorry, last century.
Mm-hmm.
So all elements were there. I had to put them together, and after two or three trips of surveying, aerial photography, on the ground, cutting lines illegally with my machete. You're not supposed to cut anything on the site. But I just had to get a view of all the... there were three monuments that absolutely lined up, two in the river and one on the plaza, which was the sort of esplanade, the jumping-off place that begun the bridge. So putting all this together with virtual... 3D computer analysis, the fly-throughs, maps, everything that would convince people that there was a bridge. But what I really had to convince them of, the fact that the city could not operate without a bridge. This city is in a big loop of the river, an oxbow, and it's about 3 meters across at the widest, but it comes down to only 400 or 500 meters where the city, the two rivers, parts of the river bend around. And this is on a really tall hill, and you really can't get across the river there, and you can't cross it with a canoe, because during the rainy season, the river is 600 feet wide, not 300. And it has tremendous trees, you know, 6-8 feet in diameter, flowing down the river, and all kinds of debris, and it's moving 10-15 miles an hour. It's you never make it across until you're 10 miles downstream. So I said, in order for the city to exist as it did, as a really sacred city, you had to have a bridge. You had to have some lifeline to the other side. And that made them think a little bit. And then when I showed the 3D fly-throughs and the computer renderings, and they were convinced a little bit. I'm talking about they being the archaeologists. But the engineers ate it up. They believed that all the materials worked. I've had, on the History Channel, I had a really famous engineering firm called Old Arp run an analysis, and they decided that I overdesigned with my six ropes. I had six ropes at each end. They said could have done without one of them. So everything I did was feasible, and it was the first of the of my discoveries. And before I knew it, I announced it in Civil Engineering magazine. And then, actually, I tried science first, and they said they didn't think they could handle that. That's funny, because they just came out with a real bombshell Maya discovery. But anyway, it was done in civil engineering, and National Geographic picked it up. And the rest is history. I just went right into the Internet.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating. I found it intriguing as well, the various stories that you have in this book about past researchers. One was a research that was done in 1934. It was the brainchild of Villa, a member of the Carnegie Institution of Washington archaeological team. And he had, you know, you have a story about him, but he also recorded the stories, and a lot of stuff is done at one time and people just ignore it. They'll bypass it, but you didn't. He recorded legends that were related to building, and the Maya said they believed that it was done with magic, and that in their legends, a lot of these great engineering works were raised by men with supernatural powers. These men were lords of the elements who, by means of a special whistle, brought life to stones that arranged themselves into marvelous and beautiful buildings and roads without the aid of human labor. And when you came across this report, it must have really intrigued you.
Absolutely. You got something for everybody. You know, my take is that they were built by the Maya engineers. And if you want to believe in, like the Maya do, the city of Kobab, where we just described the road, is the magic city. You could take the whistle. And they use the whistle to communicate in the jungle, because you can hear a whistle, and they can carry on a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the Mayans today, but by whistling. And with different tones, and you can imagine different styles. So that plus you didn't mention the creature that snares people with his tongue.
Aha! Yes,
I've scared my children with that story for years. They won't go near the place tonight. And you know, it worries me too, because you hear they got a lot of pigs and feral pigs in there, and I think I'm crunching through the underbrush, and you don't know what it is.
That's right. Now, Jim, would you stay with me a few minutes longer, because I know we're coming up on a break.
Okay.
And I would love to talk about the jadeite and the obsidian and the importance in their culture. Also, talking about a lot of the grains that were developed by the Mayan culture that ended up being in Egypt and around the world. So we are going to be coming up for a break pretty soon. So Jim is going to be staying with us for a little bit longer. The book is The Lost Secrets of Maya Technology. One of the greatest accomplishments I feel that we are experiencing right here and right now is the utilization of technology that allows us to investigate sites that are very, very ancient and find out really more about the truth, not fabrication, but the truth of what these civilizations employed in the way of their own technology and how sophisticated they really, really were. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break for a moment. When we come back, we're going to be talking more with James O'Connor. He likes to be called Jim, The Lost Secrets of Mayan Technology. And by the way, he's got a website, theoldexplorer.com. So don't go away. We're going to come right back.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you. We offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Welcome back. Today we are talking about the lost secrets of Mayan technology. My guest is James O'Conn. He prefers being called Jim, and he graciously has agreed to being with us for a few more minutes. Jim, there are so many fascinating stories that you have in your book. And I wanted to talk about the jadeite and obsidian. And I was not aware that these two stones have a hardness that is better than steel. And for surgical instruments, they're just absolutely perfect. Tell us why that's the case and how did the Mayans use it? They seem to value it more than gold.
That's true. But luckily, they had jadeite and natural sites where jadeite was found. I can't say a mine because there are these plates, tectonic plates that join right in the southern part of Mexico and Guatemala that cast these boulders of jadeite up and out. It's underground. They're on the surface, and the Mayans really treasured the green and the blue color, but the black, which is called, where iron takes the place of aluminum gives the green color, was not considered to be valuable, but it had the same characteristics, a really tough crystalline structure that the Maya used for tools. They made it into jadeite chisels, gouges, saws, augers, adzes, name all the tools. And you saw in the book, I have a whole display of them in there. And I thank my friend Felipe Kleinfelter for collecting those. And, I've got a few myself, but he's a champ. But they could do anything. The carvings that I show in the book, the facades, et cetera, are just unbelievably incised and detailed. And you couldn't use a flint tool to do that. That would be not last. It would not be able to cut the edge. In fact, at one time, this is a great, you read this too, archaeologists and geologists did not believe that any of this material came from the Americas. They thought it was all imported from China. This is like, when I was in college, they thought that jadeite was imported from China. I mean, that's crazy. Who would think the Chinese could import that kind of stuff to the Maya 2,000 years ago? And then the discovery started of sites, et cetera, down in Guatemala, and now we're back believing that there was jadeite again. But during the time after the collapse and during the post-classic and before the Aztecs had jade, but they had old Maya jade. They were like antiques. And everybody, hundreds of years have passed, everybody died off that could work the jade or knew where the sites where you gather jade was. So it just became it's like a lost mystery of the mm-hmm. Maya until they discover these things again. But jade is now valued as almost a precious stone, more than a semi-precious. However, going over to obsidian, they use obsidian for cutting instruments and for instruments of war, et cetera, because it has the sharpest blade of any material in the world. You could get down, as you read, molecular thickness, which is really low and sharp. And it's right now, you could go on the internet, you could look up obsidian scalpels, and they were for sale to doctors and mostly the thoracic surgeons and eye surgeons use them because they're so sharp they leave they heal faster and they leave a lesser scar.
Not only that, but they don't carry the bacteria the way steel does.
Absolutely.
that I found was really, that was something I had, you know, in a million years, I don't think I would have even thought of that. So here is something that the Mayans were using, and they performed brain surgery. They did all kinds of things. And here they were using tools that today's world finally recognizes as scalpels in the medical industry, that they're superior to the steel.
Absolutely.
Incredible. Now, one of the things that allows any civilization to expand is a surplus food supply. And earlier in our interview, you were talking about people when they were working 2 pounds of corn, maize, something that could keep a worker going all day long. And you bring out the information on how the Mayans worked towards achieving the maize, which they didn't have originally. They had to do hybridization until they were able to reproduce this maize that would grow in their environment. We're doing the same thing today. We're trying to figure out how grains can be adapted so they'll grow in different environments. Mr. Borlaug won a Nobel Prize for his agricultural work, and he's in our modern day, and this is something he was traveling around the world helping people with this. And here we read about Mayan technology, and they were doing the same thing a few thousand years ago. So tell us about maize and what you discovered about that, because it ended up in Egypt.
Yes, it did. I'm going to call them agronomists. These Maya agronomists had a native seed called tenosite. It was like a grain. And they, remember, they had 3,000 years to work on this stuff. So let's take the first 1,000 years. Even before that, actually, the Maya developed this grass or this grain into corn by planting and replanting and doing the things agronomists do. It took thousands of years, hundreds of years, okay? And they developed as many as 300 different kinds of corn. But when you get to the part you started talking about how did they grow so much for this big population, the Maya technicians in agriculture developed raised fields where they would go into swamps and areas that had water standing, and they would dig canals or trenches maybe 10 feet wide and make a grid pattern. So the area between the trenches would be mounded up with soil, and it would plant on top. They'd raise the soil just enough to keep the roots of the plants out of the water level. And they could grow a level of, quickly grow one or two crops up top. And then when the dry season, they could grow another crop in the canals. So they were able, plus they had a system of terraces they built that enhanced the hillsides and made them into a level planting area and allowed the fill in the walls to store water for the dry season. However, this enabled them to grow 4 times the soil, corn. Well, corn is any grain. You're correct. The maize, the tomatoes, the beans, everything. 4 times the amount that they would have done with their traditional methods. And this was enough to feed the family, feed the cities, I'm taking a typical farmer now, feed the cities and leave a surplus left over for trade that made the cities, well, enrich the cities, because trade was big business with the Maya, mm-hmm. And that's where they got all their wealth. They traded north all the way to almost to the present U.S. border, and their seagoing craft, which I do take up in the book, you saw them, traveled the Caribbean all the way down to Antigua, where they found Maya axes today. So they had a huge trade network. And the basis of it all was their agriculture, because it could feed the people. It could feed the 15 million, some people say 14. I just picked 15 because it seemed like a nice number. People in their cities, and this should have been more like a 2 million population with a normal type of agriculture.
It's an amazing story. Concrete, you mentioned that at the first part of the interview, and I wanted to come back to that, because these phenomenal pyramids, palaces, They were built with concrete. They had ventilation systems. They had running water for plumbing. They had foundations that were really solid. They were so well designed that even with earthquakes, they knew how to withstand them. They also had hurricanes that came through the area, and their structural composition was developed so that it could withstand intense winds. Fountains, stairways, you look at these beautiful buildings. The concrete was, you title it Maya cement, you say it has just been incredibly durable for thousands of years. And here you were finding all kinds of things that show what they did. And tell us about the cement, because most people wouldn't even think that the Mayans had this kind of knowledge.
I want to congratulate you again. You are one of the few people to know the difference between cement and concrete. Cement is a powder that you develop and mix with water and aggregate and make cast in place cement. That's concrete. See, I did it wrong. Concrete. And that's how they built their buildings. But this, I should say, is the singular most innovative invention they carried out, was how to make cement. In order to get cement, and we do it the same way today, we raise limestone or some other lime-based material to its melting point. When it melts, you basically have cement. You have the right chemical proportions to developed the cementitious material. But they developed this thermodynamic reactor out of wood. You saw the photos of it, of course, in the drawings. It, you know, it had like logs of 3 foot long in a circle, say 20 feet in diameter, raised about 12 feet high, with a circular cylinder open down the middle and airways in the bottom. They build this structure, and then stack the limestone that was going to be converted on top, and then start the fire in the middle. And the middle would heat up, and the temperature would go down. It would draw air in from the outside through the bottom intakes, and it would feed the fire, and it would repeat. Lower temperature, more oxygen, and it would be a cycle that would develop into a thermodynamic reactor. The heat would increase tremendously, and the flame would shoot up 130 feet in the air. In fact, there's a picture where we use a model. You can see the vertical flames. It was a small model, 3 feet in diameter. And this would go on, the process would go on for like 36 to 40 hours and burned out. And when you were finished, you had ash and cement. And that was amazing. They did that. Best we can tell, they developed that process somehow, and they do things that just, I can't believe, about 300 B.C. The Romans, of course, we know had cement, but they had a natural cement they dug out of the ground near Mount Vesuvius that they mixed with water and aggregate. But when that ran out, they quit using cement until 1851, when the British invented a process for making cement. But that was 2,100 years after the Maya pulled their trick.
Well, I'll tell you, we could probably talk for hours on this, James, but I'm sorry, we're just going to be out of time, but it's so delightful. For those of you that want to find out about a culture that has been so misunderstood on many levels, this is absolutely a mind-opening publication, The Lost Science of Maya Technology. James Okon, O-K-O-N, is my guest today. Go to his website, theoldexplorer.com, theoldexplorer.com, and you'll find out more information. And guess what? He is going to be writing another book, which, Jim, I really want you to get that to me, because this book was so good. You have so many fabulous photographs in it, and drawings, and all of this information about an ancient people that we've not had very much regard for, the appalling assumptions and arrogance of those, and ignorance of those that in the past assumed that these were people that just had a limited mentality. Far from it. They were just as sophisticated as we are, even maybe better than we are in some respects. But guess what? We become empowered with the knowledge, and it's all because of James O'Connor and other people who are dedicated to stepping outside the box of old belief systems. Thank you so much, Jim, for being my guest. Check out his website, theoldexplorer.com. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We are going to be right back.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007, that's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Hi, this is Donna. I'm sorry we've been having some technical problems here. I'm so delighted that you're able to join me. And if you'd like to call in during these last few minutes of the show, feel free to do so, 888-627-6008. And I'll be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of insight. Now, I want to let you know about the upcoming show. Then we have tomorrow. We're going to be talking the mystery at the bird feeder. Now, Wayne Brilhart is a man who loves to teach. And through art and beauty, this is what he accomplishes. So we're going to be chatting with him tomorrow. On Wednesday, I do have a speaking engagement in the morning, so I am not going to be able to do the show live, but we are going to be replaying The Lost World in America. So if you missed the show last week, I think you'll enjoy hearing it again. And then Shipwrecked, A People's History of the Seattle Mariners. Those of you that are baseball fans, John Wells is going to give us an insight into baseball that a lot of people wouldn't even imagine is there. And then on Friday, we're going to be talking with Diane Collins about quantum thinking. How can we make a difference in our lives by thinking in ways that maybe we would never have considered? Well, Diane's going to be showing that to us. So we've got a dynamic lineup this week. And if you want more information about the guests that are upcoming, go to show information. Check it out on the Donna Sebo Show. There's a little bit of an information that is posted there so that you can find out the basis of the programming that's coming up. Again, give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. And I also want to take the time right now to thank the wonderful people at the Ascension into Light Foundation in Seattle. We had a wonderful class on Saturday with the flower readings, and I intrigued them tremendously, doing something that you just don't find people doing, and that is reading flower arrangements that people bring in, telling them something about themselves without knowing who the arrangement belongs to. So they were so pleased with it, they're hoping that I'll do another class, and we will give that some consideration. Last week, I had started to tell you a story about a man by the name of Harvey and a physical condition that he was dealing with. And because of the lack of time, I really wasn't able to finish my story. So I have the time today, and I wanted to share it with you because I think it is so important. If we become aware of things, if we become knowledgeable, that's very good. But it's the use of knowledge that is valuable. That is important. You can have all the intellect in the world, and still not live a very good life because you don't know how to apply the knowledge that you gain. Well, Harvey is a man who found himself going into a facility for mammograms. Now, you don't see many men in these environments, and typically it is not thought that cancer affects many men in the breast area. However, in his family, so many women in the family had ended up with breast cancer. They had a genetic disposition for it that his sister said to him, Harvey, you need to pay attention. This could affect you too. He said, no way. I'm a guy. This can never affect me. However, one time he got a hug from someone, and this pain just shot through his chest. When his wife found out that he had experienced this kind of pain, she said, you're going to go to the doctor, period. We wives have a tendency to do that. In this case, he did listen, which was a very good thing. Well, the doctor said, you've got a situation where we need to have you go in for a mammogram. Well, you can imagine for a guy, it could be rather embarrassing because that's all you're seeing are women and breast cancer. Yes, he was diagnosed with it. And he was just absolutely stunned. Male breast cancer is extremely rare. It accounts for just about 1% of breast cancers. And they honestly don't know very much about this. Harvey decided he was going to do research on it, and he found that there was next to nothing that was available for people. However, he said, okay, let me find out what I can. So he decided he would go to the top breast cancer surgeon, and Harvey, in the research that this specialist did, they found he carried the risk-increasing BRCA2 gene. That's BRCA2 gene. And he had a particular type of cancer because of this gene. So he said, I went through what the women members in my family went through because he had to have chemotherapy. And he said, gee whiz. This is the last thing in the world I ever thought could happen to me. Now, he decided to do something, and that was because of his experience, and he's very healthy now, because of his experience, he decided that he wanted other men to be aware of this. He is cancer-free, and he and his wife, as a team, launched a nonprofit website, HIS, his breast cancer awareness, and you can go to his breastcancer.org and find out more about this. But he said it was important for him to include information on risk factors, self-exams, diet, exercise. Do you know he started getting thanks from men that were all over the world that had experienced this? And some of them were in Australia. So the guys were responding to what he was doing, saying, thank you. We have someone we can talk to. And it is absolutely important that we share what we know. And when someone can share their personal experience, it makes all the difference in the world. Well, I know we are out of time. I'm sorry that we had the interruptions that we did. But regardless, remember, always you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You have a magnificent day ahead of you today. Let that light of yours shine because who you are does make a difference. And invest in yourself. You're the best investment you've got. It's better than a bank account. This is Donna Sebo. Talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.